every meaning changed for me after her death, and the sense of her going on with me, inside me, of me being responsible for who she is because she exists inside me in the most intimate ways, made that phrase an existential one.
Coming up on In Contrast, the poetry of Forrest Gander. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Forrest Gander is the author of poetry, novels, and essays. He was born in the Mojave Desert and grew up in Virginia. Gander has taught at Harvard and Brown. His book, Core Samples for the World, was a finalist for both the 2012 Pulitzer Prize and a 2011 National Book Critics Circle Award. As a translator, Gander has rendered into English the works of poets from Latin America, Spain, and Japan. Be With, a new book of poems, will be released in 2018.
Beckoned. At which point my grief sounds ricocheted outside of language. Something like a drifting swarm of bees. At which point in the tetric silence that followed, I was swarmed by those bees and lost consciousness. At which point there was no way out for me either. At which point I carried on in a semi-coma, dreaming I was awake, avoiding friends and puking, plucking stingers from my face and arms. At which point her voice was pinned to a backdrop of vaporous color. At which point the crane's bustles flared. At which point, coming to, I knew I'd pay the whole flagpole fare. At which point the driver turned and said, "It doesn't need to be your fault for it to break you." At which point, without any lurching commencement, he began to play a vulture bone flute. At which point I grew old, and it was like ripping open the beehive with my hands again. At which point I conceived a realm more real than life. At which point there was at least some possibility. Some possibility in which I didn't believe of being with her once more.
Forrest Gander, thank you for coming to In Contrast. It's a pleasure having you. I want to start with your new book, Be With. I wonder if you could describe it for me. What type of break does this book have with your previous poetry collections?
This book comes about in the wake of my wife's death. My wife, C.D. Wright, was a major American poet, and we were together 35 years, and she died suddenly. And I didn't write for a long time afterwards, and then suddenly these poems came. I haven't had that experience before, so it was a completely different process for writing than I've had before in my life, when I've sort of needed to construct poems from notes and from a lot of gathering.
Did these poems come in the form of poems to you after C.D.'s death, or did you search for the beginning or certain lines? When you say that this is in reaction to her death, in what sense?
So I became mute after her death for at least a year. I just wanted to hole up and not see anyone and not say anything. And I couldn't write. I couldn't read. I just was, you know, almost dead myself. Being with her was the substantial act of my life. And I took on the job of teaching at the writers' community at Squaw Valley in California, where, when you go, you have to produce something every day. So I hadn't written for a year and a half, and I was there, and I needed to write. And suddenly, in the evenings, when I sat down to write, there were these things that came out that had been blocked until then, and they just came out in a gush of rawness and became the material for this book.
Was poetry finally therapeutic?
I don't think I'm ever going to be okay, but it helped me to articulate what I had blocked up and couldn't work through. So, yes.
Your poetry has always had this resonance of words that beyond the content, beyond of what they say, it is the music, the power of the sound. And because it is sometimes in long poems or in shorter poems, it is the silences in between words or in between stanzas that also strikes the reader or the listener as carefully shaped, not only what is being said, but what it's not being said. And now you talk about having been thrown into silence as a result of C.V. Wright's death and then coming out of silence. Has your relationship with silence changed?
Huh, what a beautiful question. And that whole care with which you approach a reading of my work has to do with your own experience as a writer, translator, so attentive to the sounds of work. It's interesting, the linguist Reuven Sur talks about sound patterns having meaning long before words do, and I find that to be true, and that the long O's and U's strike us differently emotionally than the tweeter sounds, and certain rhythms do as well. It's often the silence in poems that scares people. People that aren't used to silence have trouble reading poetry because silence is so part of how poetry works. I don't know if my relationship to silence has changed. I think I am more silent than ever before now. I don't know whether that's a permanent condition or not.
You might have already hinted at a response to this next question. Is also your relationship with poetry different because you had to go through this tragedy that brought along this period of silence and dramatic changes in your life? Is even the way you look at what you did prior to 2016, early in the year when C.D. Wright died, do you have different eyes and different ears toward it?
Absolutely, I do. It has changed the way that I approach other people's poetry and my own. You know, that thing that Pound says, only emotion endures, has become a kind of mantra for me. I'm less interested in the intellectual achievements of poetry and more interested in poetry delivering emotional experience. I think that doesn't exclude intellectual experience, but I'm not going to write the same way again.
She was an extraordinary poet, a major American poet, and in a household where both of you were poets, what role did poetry play?
Everything, absolutely everything. From how we named our child, his name is Brecht, to, you know, all of our discussions and our intimacies were built on the poems that we held in common and loved in common. And we were great editors for each other's work and honest editors. Poetry has had a role in every major decision that I've ever made in my life.
And how different were the two of you as poets?
Well, we were different as people. She was, she would always tease me for my militaristic discipline, and I would tease her for her complete ADD-ness, so that it seemed to me that she spent at least half a day, every day, looking for her keys or trying to find a paper or something like that. But nevertheless, she got more done than me, than almost anyone. When she came to the page, she brought a laser focus, and she was really generous in what she gave to other people as well, famously generous.
Can you bring me back to the moment the two of you met?
Yes. Thanks for asking. That's a positive thing I would like to think about. So I was in San Francisco. And at San Francisco State University, there was a fantastic library. They had a long-term reading series that started, I think, in the 50s. And they had a tremendous poetry library. And I would go there and sit on the couch. And I started reading from the A's. And about the end of my first semester, I got to the W's. And I read a book of C.D. Wright's, who happened to be working in the Poetry Center on the other side of those shelves of books. And so I engaged her because I found the book so compelling. That was an early book of hers called Terrorism, and asked her to dinner. I was into Japanese stuff in those days. I served sushi that I made myself. I went to Japantown and bought fish and bought an octopus. I didn't realize that you don't eat raw octopus. So the first thing we put in our mouths on our first date was this utterly inedible, chewy, it was like a tire full of milk. And once we'd spat that out, we sort of crossed a lot of barriers and it was easier.
You said that you were also editors of each other and sometimes blunt and direct. Now that you have produced these new poems that are part of the book Be With, without her, what is it in the editing that she brought to your previous work? What is it in the editing that she brought to your eye and to your discriminating view of how to process your own language and your own silences that you didn't have for this occasion? And how did you compensate?
I don't know that I did compensate. And I'd be interested in knowing who you show your work to also. Both of us probably receive manuscripts from so many people all the time asking us to help edit, and we're good at that because mm-hmm. done it a lot. But I don't tend to ever send my work to someone else because I had this great in-house editor. Usually I get kind of like premature ejaculation. It's a premature jubilation when I think I finished something and, you know, I show it to CD and say, read this and weep. And she doesn't exactly weep. She says, this is okay, but this isn't. And it was that moment in my cycle of working on poems when I thought it was finished and that she advised me about the ways that it wasn't, that pushed me to write better poems. I don't have that anymore.
Did that go in the opposite direction too? You doing the same thing for her poems, reaching you before they reached anybody else's eyes?
Yeah, we did it for each other. And even as a teacher, she never flattered. She was not a flatterer. She was a really straight shooter. And that honesty is really what you want most. You don't want a friend to write in your yearbook, stay the same, you know, you're great. You want someone who's taking you so seriously that they don't want to accommodate your failures.
On the other hand, Forrest, and because I also show my work to Alison, my wife, the fact that it is, as you call it, an in-house editor that happens to be the person you're living with can complicate things. There are moods and there are other elements that are descending on the page that have to do with who's the one that was supposed to pick something up at the grocery store, or did you make this phone call that I asked you to do? And in what way did poetry interfere, maybe, or alleviate elements in the relationship that the two of you had?
When there were tensions in our relationship, they were healed through poetry. She would give me a note that had a poem on it, a quote from James Wright or from Michael Ondaatje or Ann Carson. When we were alienated from each other in the normal ways that domestic couples are, poetry was often the bridge to get back on the same path. Mm. And for you?
For me too. I am not a poet the way you are or Sidi was. I am an essayist or a short story writer or translator, but that critical eye, particularly in my early years coming from Spanish into English, in being insecure if my English was right, was I able to play with certain loose ends of the language that I was not yet fully comfortable with. She gave me that security that I think I ended up internalizing. And later on, many years later, she would look at something that she hadn't seen originally and see her hand in it because her hand was still there.
That's beautiful, yeah.
You've told me when you went and met CD. How about when you met poetry for the first time?
That's sweet, too. I was raised in a house of women by my mother. I had two sisters. My biological father wasn't a presence in my life. And my mother's father, who was a Swede, Ivan Carlson, loved poetry and would recite lots of 19th century verse. Call me chief, and ye do well to call him chief, who for 12 long years fought and faced every form of man or beast the Roman Empire could provide. He would stomp around the house, you know, reciting, and I remember that, and of course my mother grew up with it, and she loved poetry, and she read to me when I was young. She loved Carl Sandburg, and she loved Edgar Allan Poe, the bells, 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 and that stimulated in me a great love for the patterns and rhythms and sounds of poetry.
And you began early to write poetry? You switched from being a reader to a writer early on?
Yes, I wrote a lot of bad poetry and thought I was quite good. You know, was sort of rewarded for the things I was writing. But when I got to William and Mary, where I went to school, my freshman year, I had a teacher named David Jenkins, who looked at some of my poetry and looked at me. This is right by the Wren Chapel, where he had a little office. And he said, "Forrest, these are terrible." And again, that honesty really took me by surprise because I thought I was such a hotshot. And then I realized I needed to read contemporary poetry much more to be a contemporary poet.
Then, many years later, you would become a teacher yourself. You taught for many years at Brown University. Did that bluntness that your professor had when you arrived to college, did you carry it along with you? Or have we reached a point in American education where that bluntness to young people is dangerous and is better put aside?
That's a tricky question, and it's a tricky position for us to be in. Certainly the students aren't used to that bluntness. A student that comes to do graduate work in poetry is taking a huge risk. There's no economy to leave and join after you graduate with an MFA in poetry. And so they tend to be anxious and looking for a lot of nurturing and support for what they're doing, no matter what it is. My tendency as a teacher was to look for the positive things that they were doing and to comment on those, to lead them out by what they did best. C.D. was blunter and respected that more, that she would talk more about what wasn't going on well.
You come also from the desert, from California. Because you create a landscape of sound and a landscape of silences, I wonder how the actual landscape, the landscape of vision, from your upbringing to the many places that you've been as a traveler, as an explorer, and even within institutions where you have taught, affects the poetry that you produce.
So I'm really interested in that question. It's true, I'm also someone who loves to inhabit the desert. I was born in the Mojave. I've been to the Gobi Desert, the Atacama, the Sahara. One of my favorite books of poems is William Carlos Williams' Desert Music. I'm very interested as a reader and a writer in how landscape might affect the language patterns of people that live in landscape. When you live in Arkansas, where C.D. and I lived for a while, you're often walking down dirt roads and talking to someone over that hump in the dirt road. And behind that person is a scrim of trees, and behind those trees are a mountain. And I think those participate in the kind of rhythms and even maybe the vocabulary that we use in those landscapes. Mary Austin talks about Abe Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. She says, was written by a man who clearly spent a lot of time chopping wood, that she can hear that in the language. I think it does impact our language, what surrounds us, and I'm interested in that relationship.
Because I can hear, as a reader and as a listener of your poetry, I can hear the different sounds, sometimes human sounds, as you're describing, the different accents, the different voices in a kind of Spoon River anthology, so to speak, that is in front of us in terms of human diversity, the sounds that come out from different landscapes. I wonder if I can just push you a little further and if you could describe for me, how do the various deserts that you've been in sound? How would you describe the difference of deserts, or maybe the time of day in which you were in a desert? Do deserts all sound the same? Do they sound different because how we've arrived to them, what we're looking for in them?
Yeah, no, they do sound different. And One of the things I like about deserts is that they're like the blank page, and that when you go before the blank page as a writer, it's first an act of listening for what's either not in you or so deep in you that you need to be focusing your attention upon it. And that being in the desert is the same way. At first it seems like a silent place, and then you hear the wind, and then you hear your steps on dry rock, for instance, and then you see a bird in a cactus, and even the sounds of ants coming out of the ground carrying beads from Native American burial places. You're sitting there and there's a sound that's so tiny, tinkling, that you're attentive to. Simone Weil talks about prayer being a sort of tuning one's attention to something beyond you. And I think the desert prepares us to do that as a poet. For Raul Zurita in the Atacama Desert, what he hears are also the sounds of the people who were chopped up and murdered and dropped in pieces on that landscape, and the people who died in the camps that Pinochet set up.
You're talking about Zurita, the Chilean poet.
The great contemporary Chilean poet, for whom the landscape is inextricably connected to human flesh in a phenomenological way.
You have talked about the influence of music, sounds, in your poetry, Silences. I wonder if music itself has had an impact on your poetry.
Absolutely. For Ashbery, it was classical music. Robert Creeley was just obsessed with listening to jazz from the same period that I'm really interested in, the 50s and 60s, where it really exploded from Miles Davis and Coltrane to Albert Eiler, just really stretching it out there. And I'm really interested in the polyphony of jazz and how that improvisation between different musicians, and it's often improvisation that they work that way on the stage live, might be accomplished in poetry. Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist, talks about thick description, trying to get everything in there. There might be a way for poetry to do that too, with a melodic line, because still a believer in the lyric.
That element that jazz has of the improvisational quality, something that I envy. And what I like about certain types of poems, certain types of your poems, is they defy that stillness or stiltness, and they want to have the more aleatory and accidental element that I think good literature incorporates. And there's another element that your comment right now made me think of, and that is music doesn't need to be translated. Literature does, but music is translationless, so to speak, because it's such a universal language.
Yeah, music and math.
And math. Uh-huh. Because you have already brought in Raul Zurita, this Chilean poet who's very connected with the Pinochet dictatorship, I wonder if this is the right time to talk about that other dimension of yours, that is the dimension of being a translator. You have translated works from Mexicans and from Chileans. Before I go there with you, Forrest, I wonder if you can describe for me again, just as you did so eloquently, the sounds of the different deserts, the rhythms of different languages. How does Spanish feel to you? How does English feel to you in contrast? What sounds do you attach to each of them and to any other language that you love encountering?
Well, different writers, of course, in different languages have very distinct rhythms, so it's hard to talk about what all of English sounds like. Ashbery sounds so completely different from George Oppen, or what Spanish sounds like. But generally, there's a musical quality to Spanish that I feel is heightened, that is more intense than in English, and it has to do with vowel sounds, I think. You hear that also in Japanese. And in Japanese, women and men talk differently. In Japanese, often you hear a rhythmic movement that women rises up at the end, and men don't do that. Going back to Reuven Sur again, he says in every language there are rhythmic patterns that are the same, that sort of unite us. Women talk to babies with an uplifting pattern, that in every language that pattern means no. and that the U and long O sounds are connected to deeper emotions than the other vowel sounds.
I want to invite you to think of that much misunderstood statement by Robert Frost that poetry is what gets lost in translation. It could also be said that poetry is what gets won in translation or achieved in translation, and that translation in and of itself is doomed, that it's impossible to bring anything from one code, that is one language, to another without having succumbed to some laws, but also without having injected something new and creative. What is a bad translation for us, and what's a good one?
Well, what you just said is beautiful and represents exactly how I think about translation. And often a bad translation is one that is most literal, where the writer thinks that the job is to render the exact arrangements of words in the exact way. And because words from one language carry different connotations and resonances and are part of a syntax which is often constructed differently, that's an impossible way to do translation, certainly of literature. And that's why Google will never translate literature successfully.
What kind of relationship, what kind of empathy do you establish with those authors that you translate? When do you know that this is an author that you would like to bring into the English language? And maybe I'll add another side to this question, because I know that you work closely with some of those authors and that sometimes those authors translate you back into your own language. So you've translated one into English and they have translated them, some of them being translators themselves. For instance, the Mexican poet Pura López Colomé has translated you back into Spanish. Talk to me about the relationship between a translator and the author that he or she chooses to bring to this language.
Yeah, well, you've done even more than I have, and I'd be really interested in how you would answer this, too. There's only one writer, the one that you mentioned, the terrific Pura López Colomé, where that relationship, I've translated her and then she's translated me, has existed. But really, first I was just her translator. It was a long time before she translated my work, and it was just the fiction that she did. And I sort of think that it works best if there isn't that relationship, if you're someone's translator, and if that they should seek a different writer to translate, except that she's the best translator in Mexico. So I felt really lucky to have her translate my work. And there's different levels of intimacy with the different people that I've translated. With her, I've spent a lot of time with Pura López Colomé. With another writer like Coral Bracho, I've spent less time with her, and she trusted me more implicitly, and I would ask her questions, and she would sometimes answer, but I was more on my own.
Meaning that the first one was more a collaboration than simply a one-way translation, or no?
I've translated a lot of her work in the two books that have come out. The first one wasn't a collaboration at all. In fact, she really thought she was helping me with my Spanish by letting me work it out myself. The second book that we did, called Watchword, we worked together on, and that was a very satisfactory relationship. With someone like Jaime Saenz, a Bolivian writer, who was dead by the time I came to translate him, co-translate him with Kent Johnson, we had to travel down to Bolivia to get to know this city, La Paz, that he almost never left, and to see the relationship between Spanish and Aymara in that city.
The aboriginal language of the place.
Right. It's not the majority population, but it's the majority indigenous population that speaks Aymara, which is, curiously, the only language that's been studied for which the future is conceptually behind them and the past in front of them. When they talk about the future, Aymara will point behind them. And when they talk about the past, they'll make waving motions in front. And the word for past is the same word as forward, and the word for the future is the same word used as for the back.
You mean physically of the body?
Physically, that the body. And they think that one proposition is that their language, in which you can't say anything like Joan of Arc burned at the cross in 1346, you can't construct a sentence like that because every sentence has to come with evidentiary information, whether you witnessed this personally or whether you overheard this. And so in a language where it's so important that something be witnessed or not, Perhaps the past, which is clear, which has been witnessed, is constructed as something in front of you that you can see, and the future, invisible, is behind you. So an interesting relationship between conception and language.
Yeah. Just staying for a minute or so more on the topic of translating an author. Translators sometimes say that the best is when the author is dead, because there's no complaints and you are freer. But are you freer when the author is not around? It doesn't sound like
no,
you are.
No, I felt much more constricted. There were so many plays that were very particular to the vernacular of La Paz that we would have failed at our translation without spending a lot of time there and talking to people that Jaime Sáenz knew and getting to know the locality, the particularity that was the source of his language.
And to what extent, Forrest, has all your work, all the extraordinary work that you've been doing as a translator, impact this shaping of your poems? Not exclusively content-wise, but in the conception, in the sounds and music and rhythms, in the harmonies, when you put together poetry?
I'll answer this question, if you'll answer it too, because I'm really curious. Translated a lot of poetry, and I wonder if that influences the prose that you write. For me, translation has completely influenced my poetry, and that's one of its beauties, is that translation brings into your body new rhythmical movements, new sounds that aren't part of the conditioned sounds of your language, and an image repertoire that's different from the ones that you use. And that's impacted and opened up my writing in a tremendous way.
Yeah, I would say something very similar. In my case, though, I have moved from the linguistic milieu that I was born into. That was first Yiddish and then was Spanish, into English. And in some ways, I live with a sense of permanent loss, of distancing, and that loss I seek through translation. I have done everything in my power not to give up the languages that were with me at the beginning, knowing very well that immigration is often the sacrifice of those original languages in search for that language that is going to allow you to live in the present. But I become aware that the Spanish that I write in, or the Yiddish, I do so much more in Spanish, can be bookish or archaic because I don't live in an environment where I'm using it all the time, or I'm not living only with Mexicans the way I was living in Mexico. Here I get in contact with Bolivians and Venezuelans and Chileans and Argentines, and that is a kind of mishmash of languages. But I absolutely agree with you. It is a two-way infusion that reshapes your mind and your heart. I think I live in translation, maybe with a loss that is inevitable with it, with a sense also that there's something that I'm telling you right now that probably could be said differently or better in another language.
Huh. And it's interesting the way you talked about translation before, that it does lose things, as Frost says, but you also said it recovers things, it creates things, and maybe that happened for you too.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's an archaeology in translation of recovering something that belongs to the past, that you bring it back to the present and it acquires a new meaning in it because you're doing that. I want to come back to the present, into this new book that you have, Be With. I love the title. For someone who has been going through such a dark period, Be With is a statement of being, it seems to me. How did you come to that title?
The title is a line from a poem by C.D. Wright, and its meaning, every meaning changed for me after her death, and the sense of her going on with me, inside me, of me being responsible for who she is because she exists inside me in the most intimate ways, made that phrase an existential one. And the book is also a conversation with her.
What are the names that you used to call her?
So her name was Carolyn D. Wright, and she would never tell anybody what the D stood for, so I won't either. And because there's another poet named Carolyn Wright, she used her initials, C.D. Wright. And my intimate name for her, I called her just C. She called me Bosque.
Bosque, because that's the Spanish for forest.
Yeah.
The very first poem of your book is a poem about and maybe for your son with C.D. It's a beautiful and it's a haunting poem. Talk to me a little about it.
You know, we had one child and her brother had no children. So her blood goes on in one person in this world, and it's not me. It's our son, who is very much like her, stubborn and really smart and very creative. And it's also a poem about how Carolyn was a great talker, and she was never in the entire time that I knew her, 35 years, she was not once uninteresting. She got a little long-winded when she recited her dreams. She would tell me her dreams in real time, so they would take about 8 hours. But aside from that, she was a fascinating person. And so the poem's also about how much she brought my soul and ears and being to attention when she spoke.
I was struck by something you said when describing the Aboriginal language, one of them in Bolivia, Aymara, and the difference between forward-looking and future or past and backward-looking, not in those two directions. And I was thinking that early on in this conversation, when you talked about her, you used the present tense. You mostly have used the past tense, but you used momentarily the present tense. And it made me think immediately, Forrest, of the way we cope with loss and grief by hesitating to give in to the way the conjugations of the verb need to be. When somebody passes away, maybe for a week or 2 weeks or however long it is that internally the person is conceptualizing the disappearance of this individual in her or his life, you will hear them use the present tense as if something was still done, a check being mailed or a kiss being given. Have you been conscious of the conjugations of yours verbally in the last 2 years?
Yes, I even noticed in our conversation, I said us, we, as if she were present. But that title, Be With, is about presence. It's about not closure, but a way of continuing with someone. And you're right, you know, in the first year, it was all loss. And now, and maybe partly through writing the poems, it's very much a sense that she's present with me. She's in my dreams. She's in the places that we were together. She's in every book in my library, which is our library.
As you know, because you're a translator and you've traveled so much, different cultures approach death in such different ways. And for some, it is just a transition between one conception of an elusive and fleeting reality and another one. And for others, it's a very drastic separation. In Latin America, in particular, a place that you've spent so much time, the idea that the dead are not gone, but they stay with us and they protect us, is in contrast with a very hygienic way that we see death in the United States. We cover the bodies quickly, we disappear them, we in some ways even are ashamed of them, and we quickly, to the degree that we can, dispose of the presence because the conception is that we need to go on, and going on with a big empty space next to us would be not going on. How have you been dealing with this in terms of the different cultures that you have? Has all this pushed you also in a direction of meditating on the larger issues of disappearance and longing and grief?
The answer is yes.
Yes, of course.
But, and I think it's important for writers to write about the things that aren't dealt with in a culture like death. So I try to do that. Interestingly, again, the Aymara believe that there's a permeable membrane between death and life. This is something that was deeply in the work of Jaime Sáenz, who wrote to death constantly as the beloved, as the city that he lived in, as you, the reader, that death was all these things. For me now, it's in me. It's in me in a way that I can never kick it out and don't want to. I don't want to get over something.
We're reaching the end of the conversation. First, then, I understand that after many years teaching at Brown University, because of what you've been going through for the last 2 years, that you have decided to give it up and move back to California. I would love to hear your reasoning on that way of reconnecting with the past that was yours, of feeling that you had reached a certain limit, maybe, or that everything tasted and sounded and connected you with C.D. Wright.
Yeah. Living with C.D. Wright, she was a giant writer, and a giant presence, this absolutely fascinating conversationalist, interested in so many things. And I'm smaller without her, and I need to make my life smaller. And being in the same house and having the same job, being in her very office in the halls at Brown that we saw each other in every day, more than 20 years, became just too painful to me. And I needed to start over, and we'd sort of planned to start over. We'd imagined a retirement in California where we'd met and where I was born. So I've moved out there early to not begin again. I can't begin again. I bring her with me and everything that we went through with me, but to continue in a different landscape in a smaller way.
Why don't we conclude with the poem, The Sun, that opens the collection Be With?
Okay. Sun, it's not the mirror that is draped, but what remains unspoken between us. Why say anything about death, how the body comes to deploy the myriad worm, as if it were a manageable concept, not searing exquisite singularity. To serve it up like a eulogy or a tale of my or your own suffering, some kind of self-abasement. And so we continue waking to a decapitated sun, and trees continue to irk me. The heart of charity bears its own set of genomes. You lug a bacterial swarm in the crook of your knee, and through my guts writhe helminth parasites, who was ever only themselves. At Leptis Magna, when your mother and I were young, we came across statues of gods with their faces and feet cracked away by vandals. But for the row of guardian Medusa heads, no one so brave to deface those. When she spoke, when your mother spoke, even the leashed greyhound stood transfixed. I stood transfixed. I gave my life to strangers. I kept it from the ones I love. Her one arterial child. It is just in you her blood runs.
I want to salute you. My admiration for your work is enormous. And in this particular moment, I want to salute you because talking about disappearance and pain is so hard and seldom done in public. And connecting it with poetry the way that you have, I think, is a light or a compass or a map to many of us. And it takes courage and it takes determination. Thank you very much for coming to
Unconscious. I'm so glad to be with you. I've been wanting to, you know, be in your company for many years. And my respect for you is enormous.
Likewise. Thank you for coming.
Placer.
Langston Hughes wrote that life is for the living, death is for the dead. Let life be like music, and death a note unsaid. A note unsaid is what one at times feels when a loved one passes. Life was plentiful, but it wasn't long enough. It should have included one more walk in the park, one more glass of wine, one more smile, one more of anything and everything. Yet death is a stop, the evidence that routine is no more, that things now start anew. Mourning is the interregnum, the step in between, the period through which we recalibrate, we look at things past and future, we ponder what matters and what doesn't. I know a woman who in mourning looked like a ghost. For 4 full years, she wasn't herself. She had lost her companion, her other half. She was now incomplete. And in her incompleteness, she lost the capacity to enjoy. Everything seemed plain to her, uninteresting, lacking in quality. There were other loved ones around her, but her center of gravity had vanished. Mourning isn't an act. It's a state of being. It requires empathy, patience, fortitude. What is most needed, I have come to understand, is the capacity to relearn one's language. Words have to be redefined. Yes, mourning is about being speechless, about silence. Everything appears quiet, without music. Everything seems remote, as if one were trapped in a fishbowl. Sounds arrive as if through a membrane that protects us from them. They seem unintended for us, alien. Silence. But then sounds reemerge. The rediscovery of life is the reacquisition of words. Mourning slowly passes. It leaves us alone. It gives us permission to exist again. We'll never be as complete as we once were, but we will be. And that's enough. Next time on In Contrast.
This idea of the face as being a kind of a map, a cartography, was interesting to me. But of course, because I'd been thinking so much about time, I started to think of it more as a map that emerges through time.
Ruth Osecki on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our intern is Delina Hatgu. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.